School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. China has a long history of conducting surveillance on its population, but technology is now allowing the government to keep tabs on its people in ways that are perhaps unparalleled in human history. In particular, China is conducting an extraordinary program of mass surveillance in the western province of Xinjiang. Now, more than half of Xinjiang's 24 million people are ethnic Uyghurs. Now, this is a Turkic-speaking Muslim minority group that has long chafed under rule from Beijing. In the past 3 years, China has aggressively expanded a campaign against them called Strike Hard Against Violent Extremism. This effort has led the state to intern hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in political re-education and detention camps, and it's been enabled by a vast surveillance state that collects huge amounts of personal data, including people's genetic information, their travel, and even their personal networks. So on today's show, we'll be learning more about this effort and how the technologies it employs may be adapted elsewhere. To start, we're going to look at one major tool in this effort, and that's an app that Chinese police and other officials use that helps them collect and access vast troves of data on Uyghurs. For that, we're going to bring in Sophie Richardson. She's the China director of Human Rights Watch, which published a report on this app back in May. Sophie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this app is called the Integrated Joint Operations Platform, or IJOP. Your group was able to obtain it and sort of reverse engineer it. So just tell us who uses this app and what kind of information is on it.
Yeah, the app is used by police and other government officials in Xinjiang to do a couple of different things. It's both to receive information about people they have stopped and are questioning. It also lets them provide information back into kind of the central brain of surveillance, which is the IJOP platform. We can talk about that in a minute if you want. But also the app then crunches the data and essentially tells police or other government officials what to do with the people they're talking to, whether they have been deemed sufficiently suspicious to warrant further investigation or detention. And it's really important to understand that many of the behaviors that we found the app tracking are legal. They're not necessarily crimes or you know, evidence that would, in a normal legal system, warrant further investigation. There's almost no way to challenge it either.
Okay, well, sure. Well, talk to us about what some of these behaviors are that this app, this platform tracks.
I think the one that probably stood out most prominently in our minds was that if you suddenly start using the back door of your house instead of the front door, or if various forms of facial recognition software and license plate recognition software determine that you are putting gas in a car that does not belong to you, if you have suddenly started talking to your neighbors more or less, all of these kinds of behaviors are detected through different surveillance systems and aggregated, and authorities use that as a basis of deciding whether they should be worried about you or not.
Okay, so it sounds like the information on this app, it's quite different from what, say, the FBI or police in the U.S. use to keep data on criminal suspects then.
Yeah, the IJOP platform as a whole has access to all different kinds of government information, you know, some of which, you know, is considered normal information for law enforcement to look at. If you have a criminal record, for example, or, you know, if you're wanted by the court for certain kinds of violations, although in China, even those can be highly debatable. But many of the kinds of behavior that the app is tracking are perfectly legal and have nothing to do with criminal activity.
Sure. I mean, give us just a few more examples of those. I mean, it sounds like they're getting data from like a huge number of different sources if they're able to track where you refuel their car. Like, obviously, that system, that sounds like that might be like an electronic surveillance system. But which door you use on your house, it sounds like they would need human intelligence to gather information like that.
Well, either that or, you know, I mean, it's a region that's awash in things like surveillance cameras or facial recognition software. Some people now have QR codes outside their homes so that officials can scan and track who lives there and even log information about the behavior of people who live there. But some of the other behavior that the app tracks is how often people go to mosques, for example, how religious they are deemed to be. whether they have relatives overseas and whether they're talking to them regularly. The app also looks at whether you have any one of 51 different kinds of communications platforms, things like Viber or Telegram, and how often you use those. So there are a lot of different forms of different streams of information that inform the central IJOP platform. You know, and this app is just one piece of that larger architecture of surveillance.
Okay, so what is the Chinese government's, what is their goal in gathering all this data?
Well, I think part of the goal is to let people know that every last aspect of their behavior can and will be surveilled, but also to punish people they think are behaving in ways that they don't want, modifying that behavior. But also, you know, the purpose, you know, when you see an authoritarian regime use such arbitrary tools, part of the purpose is to keep people guessing and afraid that any kind of behavior they may choose to engage in could get them in trouble. And so they're going to be maximally compliant. That's part of the point here.
I mean, the Chinese government says that it's using this to head off extremism, potential terrorist attacks. There have been incidents in this region in the past of separatist groups launching attacks. But the amount of data on this app is enormous. It seems like one of the things it may allow them to do is sort of predict where certain attacks may come or certain criminal activity may occur.
Well, look, if they believe that how often you talk to your neighbor or which door you go out might suggest that, maybe that makes a certain amount of sense. But let's be very clear. The Chinese government has already a very extensive legal system, legal architecture to try to track and prosecute any kind of criminal or terrorist activities. And you know, it tends to be antithetical to both of those goals to simply criminalize all behavior, because it makes it very hard to disaggregate what constitutes a real threat. But you know, this is the pretext that the Chinese government wants, essentially, to carry out an extraordinary campaign of repression across the entire region.
And like, how many people's information is in this app? I think there's, we said there's something like 24 million people that live in this province, about half of whom are Uyghurs. Like, how many people's data is being swept up in this?
Well, maybe someday we'll know. It's really hard to tell just how many different individuals have been tracked by this. But one of the ways that we came to be aware of this was when interviewees we were talking to about their experiences in political education camps were describing, completely independent of one another, virtually the same kinds of technological tools used by the police when they were being questioned. And so I think we can probably reasonably conclude that because China has a national ID system based on biometric IDs, that anybody who has an ID in that region is probably logged in this system.
Okay, so it may be virtually all adults or at least all Uyghurs then, potentially.
It's certainly plausible.
Well, Sophie Richardson, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about China's mass surveillance program in the western province of Xinjiang and how the tactics it employs may be adopted elsewhere. And so for more on this, we're going to bring in two other guests who've been researching this. Joining us from Beijing is Chris Buckley, a China correspondent for the New York Times. Chris, welcome.
Good to be here.
And with us in Washington is Dahlia Peterson. She's a research analyst at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Dahlia, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Chris, let me start with you. You have traveled to Xinjiang in the past, I understand. Give us just a sense of what it's like there on the ground. Like, how do you experience government surveillance there?
I've been to Xinjiang several times, including most recently about a month ago. And one of the striking things about the system of surveillance there is it's really emerging a combination of the new forms of advanced technology that Sophie was just talking about with very old school forms of surveillance and control that really go back decades in China. And when I talk about those old school forms of control, I'm talking about neighborhood committees, neighborhood surveillance, officials going from door to door, regularly questioning people who they consider to be persons under suspicion. So it's really the merging of those two forms of control that bear down on Uyghurs at the moment. And both of those forms of control really work with each other now. So a lot of the information going into these systems is collected through interrogations. And of course, both of those forms of control can be very intimidating for Uyghurs in the region.
Well, Dalia, if you would just give us a little bit of background briefly about why the Chinese government feels the need to build this very elaborate surveillance system in this part of China.
Yes, so there's been a long history of tensions between Uyghurs and the Han majority and the central government at large. These ethnic tensions have been steadily rising and have peaked starting from 2009 when there was a terror attack in Urumqi that led to over 100 people killed. Since then, China has been steadily cracking down upon Uyghurs, and this escalated most significantly following the launch of the Strike Hard campaign that you mentioned earlier that began in 2014. But essentially, as Sophie was mentioning earlier as well, the goal here really is to very significantly counter the terrorist threat that China perceives is pervasive across every possible Uyghur in the region. So they really want to root out the Uyghur identity at its very core.
And this is something that we're going to return to later in the show. But Chris, I want to return to you because you reported on a demonstration of China's surveillance capabilities that I think you saw or one of your colleagues saw at a trade fair earlier this year. Talk to us just a little bit about what you saw and how sort of the control structure looks.
Yeah, this was a demonstration seen by my colleague, produced by a company called CETC, which is one of the big Chinese corporations which has been developing technology quite specifically for the security drive in Xinjiang. And like the IJOP that Sophie was describing, this is a platform that collects information, particularly on the movements of people. And so, as I was saying before, these surveillance systems often use old, more traditional forms of control as well. And one of those very traditional forms of control is separating out Uyghurs from other ethnic groups and putting them through more surveillance and more checkpoints than other groups as well. So what these surveillance systems do is to monitor people, their movements as they leave their village, as they step out of their apartment complex, as they go into a marketplace, as they perhaps, for example, go into a mosque. And this allows the police and other authorities to build up a detailed picture of where people are going, who they're socializing with, and who they're communicating with.
And so a lot of this data is gathered through checkpoints and through traditional police, then, it sounds like, Chris.
Yes, what you do see in Xinjiang is that a lot of the social control there, it's not just based on facial recognition technologies. Sometimes it's much simpler than that. It's simply corralling people through checkpoints and often taking records from their ID cards as they move through, and sometimes obliging them to have to do photo ID checks as well to establish that they are the person on the ID card.
And one of the things that you described also was that the technology allows for sort of a God's eye view of, say, an entire city and the movements of people within it.
That's very right. I think what we do see from government documents, from observation out there, from occasional reports, is that this technology is far from perfect. The facial recognition cameras are far from perfect. But that doesn't mean that this isn't a very intimidating form of technology. In fact, what it means is that there's a great deal of arbitrariness in who can get caught in the net of this technology. And it may be improving gradually over time so that it becomes more specific or more focused. But the way it works now is simply by catching many Uyghurs in this enormous net of checks, cross-checks, investigations, and interrogations.
Well, Dalia Peterson, I wanted to ask you how this level of surveillance compares with surveillance systems elsewhere in China.
Yes, so I have done quite a bit of research on other surveillance programs that were present across China. One of these, so to begin with, while Xinjiang is certainly the testbed for these technologies and surveillance is most omnipresent, in Xinjiang, and people there experience the greatest amount of repression. Certainly remiss to believe that others across China are not being targeted as well. Certain programs, most notably, there is the Skynet surveillance program that is present in 16 cities and provinces across the country. There is also the Safe Cities programs, which are being exported worldwide. And I can mention a few examples later on. The program that I studied the most in depth is a lesser known program called Sharp Eyes, which is also present nationwide and was launched in 2015. This program is present in both major metropolises, but also more in rural areas. The main goal for that is to make up for the lack of rural security presence in these areas. And essentially what it is, it's very alarmingly Big Brother, but it crowdsources villagers via government-provided TVs and remote control systems that allow citizens to surveil video feeds from the comfort of their own home. And then if they see a crime happening, they can report it with the press of a button on their remote control, or they can report it via specially designed apps. These then feed directly into local command and control centers, which again, there is a great deal of human involvement needed there to scan all the footage coming in. But the issue with these programs, especially for it's not only putting everyone under surveillance, but it's also putting a great deal of scrutiny on what Human Rights Watch calls focus personnel. These are dissidents, these are people with a history of petitioning the government, those with a history of terrorism, and these people are especially put under the magnifying glass to be scrutinized and entered into police cloud databases that put them under extra scrutiny.
Well, Chris, I know you've lived in China for a couple decades now. Do you have a sense as to how Chinese people themselves feel about this level of surveillance? I mean, clearly in Xinjiang, I would think that the Uyghurs in particular are unhappy about it, but sort of the Chinese public more broadly, like how readily do they accept this level of surveillance?
I think there's an emerging conversation about this in China. First of all, of course, living under this one-party state, Chinese people for decades have become accustomed to a level of surveillance and monitoring by the state that surpasses what people in liberal democracies would be used to. Even so, these new technologies are intruding in people's lives in ways that are raising questions here. So, for example, in the past few weeks, we've seen a debate breaking out online about certain software programs and monitoring programs that watch children in school using facial recognition technology to monitor and to evaluate their behavior. And that's the kind of intrusive surveillance that even in China, where people are more accustomed to being looked at by the state, that is raising concerns here. And I think we're going to see those debates continuing. At the same time, what the Chinese government is essentially offering its citizens is a bargain, a deal which says that if you accept our control of you, if you accept the boundaries we put on your behavior, if you accept the surveillance that we impose on you, we're going to promise you a level of safety and security so that you can go about your life without fearing robbery, crime, and all of the other violence that China shows is happening in the rest of the world. So for Chinese people, it's going to be a question about whether they accept that bargain as it's put to them by the government, or whether, as I think will happen, more and more Chinese people begin to question the assumptions that go behind it.
Well, Dahlia, our time is growing short, but you had mentioned that a number of these Chinese companies are exporting this technology, not just outside of Xinjiang, but to different countries around the world. Tell us about that.
Yes. So a recent report by my colleague Valentin Weber just showed that China has been exporting surveillance technology and censorship technology to over 75 countries since 2005. And one of the aforementioned state-run defense contractors that I believe Chris mentioned, the China Electronics Technology Group Corporation, also known as CETC, it's exported its equipment to countries including Russia, Australia, South Africa, and Ecuador. Huawei has built safe cities projects in over 100 cities worldwide. And in certain cases, these surveillance technologies, they are built with preconditions built into them. So for instance, safe cities projects built in Pakistan, a leaked government document, Chinese government document showed that this was a precondition of Belt and Road participation. In Ecuador, in response for building surveillance equipment for its surveillance system called the ECU-911, there were oil exports being granted in return.
Okay, so it sounds like clearly this was linked to some of China's commercial interests then as
well. Yes.
Yeah, but Dahlia, yes. Chris, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but thanks so much for taking the time to join us. A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about China's mass surveillance program of its Muslim minority in the western province of Xinjiang. Up next, we're going to hear about how this campaign of surveillance, detention, and political re-education affects ordinary Uyghurs. And for that, we're going to bring in Omar Kanat. He's the vice president of the World Uyghur Congress, an exile group. He joins us now from Washington. Omar, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have lived in the U.S. for years, but I understand that you still have family and relatives in Xinjiang. What do people that you know there, what do they say about the surveillance that occurs there?
So, first of all, I would like to say that it's not necessarily only the advanced technology the Chinese authorities has been using to surveil Uyghurs. They are sending, party activists to the Uyghur homes. You know, they stay in the Uyghur homes. They monitor the Uyghurs in their homes and then report to the government.
Yes, I understand that there has been a program where Chinese communist cadres were to be sent to Uyghur homes to spend the night in the effort to sort of develop a sense of family between the two groups.
It's a very humiliation for the Uyghurs. For the Uyghur tradition, Uyghur culture, that these are strangers, you know. You have to host a stranger that you don't know him, and you have to treat him very well. Otherwise, he will report to the government that you have, bad intentions and different thoughts about the government's treatment of the Uyghurs. So therefore, you have to, treat these people very well. And what is happening is Chinese authorities already put
Just to connect this to our earlier discussion, it sounds like while Uyghurs may be getting visited by Communist Party officials, one of the things they're doing is monitoring them to see if they have any of these sort of suspicious behaviors that China tracks in these massive databases, such as...
Yes, they have to report to the government what you eat, what you think, what you watch, and what you speak at home about. So... whether you are praying, so it's not possible for the Uyghurs pray in front of these strangers. Otherwise, you would be in the camp. So this is repression. The current repression destroyed the Uyghur life, the Uyghur economic life, the Uyghur social life. So they are not, this surveillance. You are under surveillance 24/7. So people even. Afraid to talk to each other. It destroyed the social life. The Uyghurs. They don't talk to each other anymore. And also, surveil the Uyghurs or monitor the every movement of the Uyghurs in Uyghur homeland, but they already extended their long arm to other countries, especially, for example, in the U.S. Since its campaign of mass detention began. The Chinese
Omar, I want to come back. I want to come back to surveillance of Uyghurs overseas in just a moment here. I should also point out that we did reach out to the Chinese embassy to try to get their perspective on the surveillance program as well. But one of the goals that it sounds like this surveillance, this level of surveillance has, is to identify people who are suspicious and who may be sent to these political re-education or detention camps where, as we mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people have been sent for indoctrination into Communist Party thought. I mean, tell us a little bit more about what occurs in these camps.
So in these camps, people are being, first of all, the people are being forced to renounce their religion, renounce their culture, renounce their tradition, renounce their very identity. So all the people who have been put in this camp are put in the camp because of their ethno-religious identity. So the Chinese intention in creating these camps and putting people in the camps are to eliminate the Uyghur culture, Uyghur language, and Uyghur identity. This is the aim of the Chinese government. So therefore, many Western scholars already called it a crime against humanity, a cultural genocide.
Well, it seems like the Chinese government's goal is to make Uyghurs ultimately more loyal to the Chinese Communist Party. You talked about all these limits on Uyghur culture, on the practice of Islam. Is this working?
No, the intention is not to make the people to, you know, only to loyal to the Communist Party, to exterminate their culture, exterminate their identity. It's not only a policy to make these people loyal to Communist Party.
Is it effective?
It's in some cases it's effective because, as you and me have seen the from the Human Rights Watch report, they separated children from the parents, and now these children is going to grow up with another culture, another language, unaware from their culture, their tradition. So this is a big loss for the Uyghur people.
Well, Omar, our time grows short, but I understand that China, as you mentioned, extensively surveils Uyghurs overseas, including activists like yourself. Talk to us just a little bit about that.
So as I said, since this campaign began, China escalated its intimidation of the Uyghurs in other countries. They began a systematic, implementing a systematic policy of, inflict pain and suffering on the Uyghurs abroad, preventing, for example, Uyghur American community from enjoying their constitutionally protected rights and freedoms, and escalated its intimidation, including threatening Uyghur Americans with placing their family members in the camps if they don't listen to them, if they don't do the things they want them to do. And they Chinese agents keep calling the Uyghur Americans and also other Uyghurs in European countries to be silent.
So it sounds like this creates fear among people even overseas,
yes,
because they fear for their families back
in
Xinjiang.
Omar,
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Sophie Richardson, Chris Buckley, Dahlia Peterson, and Omar Kanat. Our assistant producers this week are Laura Miserez and Ariana Suardi. Trevor Hook is supervising producer. Benjamin Brink is visual editor. Takiya Thomas is audio engineer. And Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.